You've got me, girl, on the run around, run around, got me all around town. You've got me, girl, on the run around, and it's getting me down. If you wanna find a lover, then you look no further, for I'm gonna be your only. Searching at the start of the season, and my only reason is that I'll get you.
I've been up all night again. Party time waits
I've seen the meaning in my latest fling. It's the same old story, all love and glory. It's a pantomime. If you're looking for love in a looking glass world, it's pretty hard to find. Divine intervention, always my intention, so I take my time. I've been looking for something I've always wanted but was never mine. But now I've seen that something just out of reach, glowing very holy grail. Oh, mother of pearl, lustrous lady of a sacred world. Thus even Zarathustra, another time loser, could believe in you. With every goddess a let down, every idol a bring down, it gets you down. But the search for perfection, your own predilection, goes on and on and on and on. Canadian club love, a place in the country, everyone's ideal. But you are my favorita, and a place in your heart, dear, makes me feel more real. Oh, mother of pearl, I wouldn't change you for the whole world. You're highbrow, holy, with lots of soul melancholy shimmering. Serpentine sleekness was always my weakness, like a simple tune. But no dilettante, filigree fancy beats the plastic you. Korea girl cover, exposed and another slips right into view. Oh, looking for love in a looking glass world, it's pretty hard for you. Few throwaway kisses, the boomerang hisses, spin round and round. Fall on feather bed quilted, faced with silks of the stuff I dirt down. Take refuge and pleasure, just give me your future, we'll forget your past. Oh, mother of pearl, submarine lover in a shrinking world. Oh, lonely dreamer, your choker provokes a picture of cameo. Oh, mother of pearl, so, so semi-precious in your detached world.
Oh, mother of pearl, I wouldn't trade you for another girl. Oh, mother of pearl, I wouldn't trade you for another girl.
You're listening to WGXC Accra 90.7, The Wave Farm, music for open ears. This is the newest installment of a monthly show called Reading is Functamental. My name is Sal Cataldi. I'm a local musician. You may know me from a band called Spaghetti Eastern Music or The Vapor Vespers or Guitars of Go-Go. I'm also a writer about music for the New York Times, Rolling Stone, and NewYorkStateMusic.com, where I review books. And this is one of them. Today's guest is one of my favorite guitar players of all time. Not only a great guitar player, a great writer, a great producer, Phil Manzanera, best known for Roxy Music, but a bunch of solo albums, the band 801, Quiet Sun, collaborating with everyone from Dylan to Pink Floyd and David Gilmour. He's here to talk about, in his new book, which is an incredible memoir called Revolution to Roxy. What's really interesting about this book is it's not your typical VH1 or too much all about music. He talks a lot about his very interesting life and his early life, where he was a sort of a globe-hopping son of a British Airways executive. So he was actually in places like Havana, Cuba, when Fidel marched into town. We talk about his early interest in music, his era getting into Roxy, the early days of Roxy, the three different eras of Roxy, the various breakups and reunions. Also, his wonderful solo career, which began with the album Diamond Head. Also, he did a lot of production of Rock Espanol. He hosted this incredible guitar fest, 5-day event in Spain. And we're going to lastly hear about how, due to Kanye West and sampling by Kanye West and Jay-Z, 20 notes that he played and sort of summarily forgot on the beginning of a track from K-Scope, one of his solo albums, which was sampled, and he says via that sampling he made more from that one sample than he did 50 years playing and touring with Roxy and all his various solo projects. So without further ado, let's bring on the greatest guitar player in art rock, in my opinion, Phil Manzanera. Well, thank you so much for joining us. One of my favorite guitarists, also composers, producers, Phil Manzanera, who is here talking about his fantastic memoir. I'll let you pronounce it, but I believe it is Revolution to Roxy.
Correct. Well done. Revolution.
Revolution. Well, I think one of the most interesting parts of your book is sort of your pre-music history, which is where I'd like you to start, if you can, speaking a little bit about Cuba and being related to a Colombian pirate, possibly a spy, and an Italian opera singer.
You're going to think I made this up. I mean, even I, when I'm saying this, I'm thinking, yeah, sounds like I'm making this up.
No.
Of course, you know, doing the memoir was trying to like make sense of what happened, where we came from, our family, and also what happened musically in the 52 years that Roxy had been going. So, yeah, when aged, I was born in London, but age 6, I was taken to Havana, Cuba, by my parents, my British father and Colombian mother from Barranquilla, Colombia, put into a Cuban school. Within 3 months, I could speak Spanish. I'm bilingual. I've always been bilingual. And we were there during the Cuban Revolution, and we lived opposite the chief of staff of the dictator, Batista. So it was gun battles from our house. And recently, I watched The Godfather 2 again.
Right.
The Godfather Part 2, there is a scene in Havana, in exactly the time when we were there, at the end of when we were there, during the night of the revolution on New Year's Eve. And you see they reenact the ballroom scene on New Year's Eve with the president, and they're all dancing and whatever. And some guys come in and say, Che Guevara and Camilo Cienfuegos, their tanks, they've taken Santa Clara, they're on their way to Havana, let's get the hell out of here.
Right.
So them, it's hilarious, they're all running for their cars in all their party dresses. Now, if the camera moved like 2 miles to the right, they'd see our family in our garden with a gun battle going on,
Right.
shooting at the chief of staff of the dictator. All the presidents, and all his men were on their way to the military airport to Scarpa with half the money from the Bank of
Right.
Cuba, which was like 10 minutes from our house, the military airport. So it was all happening. We were like on the bathroom floor, my mother screaming, the bullets flying everywhere. I have no recollection where my father was.
Right.
And I asked my brother, where was dad? Later, when we had to leave Cuba because it was too dangerous, and my dad got transferred to Hawaii, he did an interview in a newspaper, which is in the
Right.
book. And
Right.
from that, I gathered a lot of stuff of what happened, validated what I thought happened. And
Right.
he's talking about it in the interview. So anyway, that's where I first picked up a guitar. That's the first place my mother started having guitar lessons on a little Cuban guitar
Right. Which you
being
still
accompanied,
own, correct?
which I still own. There's a picture of
Yes,
it.
the book, by the way, is profusely illustrated with wonderful family archive, really. And the beauty of the
Yeah.
book is that it's way beyond the typical cliche of the VH1 Behind the Music. It is very much a family history to some extent, integrated with your music history, which is a lot more than Roxy, as anyone who has ears and will read this book will find. But let's speak about your how you got interested in music. And I know that we could talk about your Hofner Galaxy, very handsome guitar, and also your relation, kind of ongoing relation with the McCormick brothers, which.
Yeah, no, totally. Well, the Hofner Galaxy guitar, which is downstairs. But the story behind the Hofner Galaxy guitar is that I am sitting in a room in Caracas, Venezuela, aged like nine, and I'm listening to American college kids who have come over in the vacations and are playing at parties that I was at a school in Venezuela, in Caracas, and we're going and we're watching these guys playing Buddy Holly and playing Beach Boys by then. And me and my Venezuelan friends said, we got to get electric guitars because all our classmates,
Right.
the girls sort of like looking at these guys. Normal story of why a lot of musicians start because
Well,
they.
you were a pretty good sportsman though, so you did had that, you could have
Yeah,
stayed in that lane.
so I could have, but then I go to England
Go ahead.
and with the £5 I buy on what they call hire purchase here, a Hofner Galaxy guitar, not realizing that you have to pay £5 every month. And I
Right.
get a solicitor's letter and they try and take me to court, but my father pays it off. That's how I get an electric guitar. But I'm in England from the beginning of the 60s
Right.
at what we call school till 1969. And then everything happens. Like for so many people my age in America, the Beatles happen and everyone goes wild. The Stones, the Kinks, the Who, Jimi Hendrix arrives. He just Pink Floyd, everything happens, and I'm there watching all these people
Right.
and dreaming, having a dream about becoming a professional musician.
Well,
And I'm 16, and I say to my mother, my father's died in South America,
Right.
16. I say to my mother, yeah, I'm going to continue my studies, but I want to be a rock and roll musician. She has no idea what a rock and roll musician is.
Well,
She
she.
says, like she's a little lady from Barranquilla. I love cumbia and salsa and everything. What is rock and roll? And I said, and my brother says, look, I know this guy who's just joined a band. Let's go and ask him what you have to do to become a professional musician.
Right.
He's just joined a band. And that was David Gilmour.
Right.
So how lucky was I,
Who you would continue to work with later on. But let's talk about your entry into the whole Roxy order orbit. You were the second guitarist, obviously replacing Davey O. List, and you also had the band Quiet Sun. The prog band was kind of a predecessor of Roxy, and then and whatever that word is, antecedent or something
Yeah,
after opera.
whatever.
But
Yeah.
go ahead. Yeah. Sorry, it's getting too fancy.
Okay.
I should just keep it one syllable.
So, in the late 60s at school, we formed a band with my good friends. I call them McCormick Brothers. Bill
Right.
McCormick, great bass player, who was in 801 Live and Quiet Sun and with Robert Wyatt's band eventually. And his brother, who became a famous journalist, ran the
Right.
NME in England. They were very influential on me, that they were meticulous and detailed, and they turned me on to all this American music that was coming out, Zappa, the Doors, Jefferson Airplane, the Velvet Underground, everything that was happening in the States. So we were there listening, buying imports, getting influence. And we formed a sort of a band that was a bit like a prog band, if you like.
Right.
It was very much like based on the Soft Machine, what Soft Machine became. And then eventually Robert decided to, or got, they sacked him, I think, from Soft Machine. And he formed a new band, and my friend Bill McCormick joined that. So
Right, that
I
was
said,
matching
what am I
mall.
going to, matching more.
Right.
And so they said, well, I said, what am I going to do? And they said, well, there's this band called Roxy. They put an ad in the Melody Maker. Why don't you
Right.
audition for it? Yeah, and then I failed the audition. That's why Dave
Right, the
O'Leary got
first
the
time
gig.
around, exactly.
Yeah. And then it didn't work out with him, and they called me, and then it all happened incredibly quickly. I was like, it was my 21st birthday, the 31st of January. The 3rd of January, I went for this other supposed audition. The following week is by the 14th of February, that's the date of the first contract, Roxy contract.
Right.
I did six gigs in a pub. We went, recorded the first album. 3 months later, it came out on the same day as Ziggy Stardust.
Right.
Same week, Ziggy Stardust and our album came out. We supported Bowie at a pub in Croydon. He was right on the way up everywhere, and he, liked us and was very generous and had us as a support act. And suddenly we were in the charts, like, and it all happened like Christmas
Very
every day.
quickly, yeah. Well, who let's talk about your influences. Who were your early influences on guitar?
Oh, well, obviously, George Harrison, then
Interesting.
Keith Richards, I went through everybody. Then it was Clapton, and then it was, but then it was Randy California,
Yeah.
and then, see, it was Hendrix with a, well, I just, when I saw Hendrix's first appearance on television, I could not, I just leapt towards the television. I could not believe what I was hearing. It was the most exciting thing in the world. But then, I loved the early John McLaughlin albums.
Right.
That just the guys in the Velvet Underground, Sterling Morrison, Lou Reed, anarchic kind of playing, all sorts of John Cipollina, Quicksilver, you name it. There's just so many amazing guitarists to like be influenced by.
Well, you can hear a lot of that in your style. I mean, to me, let's talk about the working process of Roxy. It's kind of an unusual band, I gather. A lot of times the music would come first. You guys wouldn't even know what the lyrical content was. And then the way you approached doing your guitar parts was interesting to me. And when you said George Harrison, I kind of think of you as a cross between like Harrison, very mannered, like thoughtful. This is going to be immortalized forever on record, and I want it to be perfect. And then you also have a certain, wild abandoned style, which is the Hendrix part of you, the Fripp part of you. So let's talk about how Roxy worked in those early days in terms of composition and your approach to your creating your guitar parts, which were so unusual, and then also impacted by Eno's treatments. And I always
Yeah.
wondered if you were sort of a gearhead before that. So that's a lot, that's a loaded question, but pick out where you were.
There's a lot to unpack there. Okay, well, let's, if you start at the beginning, and the first Roxy album, okay, that's like on the fly, done very, very quickly in 2 weeks, Some of the parts had already been worked out actually by the different guitarists that came along. So to a certain extent, I was, fitting in with everything. When you get from the second album onwards, we have Chris Thomas, the producer who was George Martin's assistant. So when you say like the George Harrison thing, you're bang on, because what he brought to us was the George Martin Abbey Road way of recording albums, part playing that fitted in together. And you had to come up with something beautiful that's simple, but worked within this context of all the people. So I would go home with a Revox tape recorder and just spend hours trying to work out guitar parts. I'd come to the studio and say, look, I've got these three different ideas. Hopefully you'll like one of them. Most of the time they liked one more than the other. Sometimes they like two and there's two, and sometimes they like three and there's three, till you get to like the fourth or fifth album. There's like five guitars. It's like, this is ridiculous. Let's get some oboe in here. Well, whatever. But yeah, so it was meticulous from that point of view. And you're absolutely right. What happens is the mixture of the George Martin Abbey Road school of production recording mixed with the influence of Brian Eno and our love of Velvet Underground and like anarchic sort of stuff and systems music. And so there's a wide musical palette to draw on depending on the song. But what we did in Roxy was tr try and create a musical world for that Brian's voice could inhabit, so it was all about trying to create something different and special. And it was made up of lots of little bits and maybe like l the mixture. I always say the Roxy sound is just like a combination of all our inadequacies. Because we weren't technically, if we were too technical, it would have been horrible. But because all the simple bits just seemed to lock together a bit like reggae, and it created a unique sort of sound, with obviously with a distinctive Bryan Ferry voice.
But again, it seems like some of what I've read is that in terms of Ferry's compositions, it would be just music first. So you would really have no idea what, like Love Is the Drug or tunes like that. You really don't know what the subject matter is. So you're kind of making it.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And here's the thing. No, none of us could write a song to save our lives, a proper song. You watch Let It Be, the film with the Beatles, you see, Paul McCartney, long and winding, nothing like that. No, I mean, Brian would come with four chords with no top line, nothing. Here are the four chords. Right. And just everyone would just play whatever they want, construct some sort of weird thing. He'd take it away and try and write a top line. Well, that happened, I'd say 95% of the eight albums that we did. So it was a hit or miss. Sometimes it was brilliant, sometimes it was rubbish. I won't say which ones are rubbish, obviously, though.
So what
But
was it like to have again, I read early Roxy when Eno was in the band live, sort of treating everything. How did it feel to have your sort of guitar mutated live and in the studio? I'm assuming in the studio you would have more say into what would be committed, whereas live, it's just happening on the fly.
yeah, I mean, when I first joined, there was this ridiculous thing where there were no amps on stage. Everything went DI'd into Eno, who was standing in the audience. And it was so unsatisfying that we rebelled immediately and got amps. And of course, in the studio, we were also subject to the producer. So he couldn't get, he was slightly frustrated because he couldn't get his way totally all the time. And everyone had an opinion. But personally, his treatment of my guitar was just like great fun. Sometimes I'll be playing something on stage and I'd be hearing the sound and thinking, what is that? I'm just a source, a signal source. But we laughed a lot. There was a lot of humor and we like hammed it up. I would like end up on my back, with the feedback, with him treating the feedback and stuff like that. So there was a lot of humor to it. It wasn't very sort of Avant garde blue face
Yeah.
music.
Well, speaking of hamming it up, let's talk about your signature visual style. Obviously, Roxy, the band, is known for its album covers, art school approach. And you kind of were the sort of odd man out. Also, yourself and Paul, you kind of had more of a, like, slightly a hippie look. So they had to do something to you.
Yeah.
So
Token hippie.
how did you come up with that look that's immortalized on the first album?
Yeah, well, I wish I could say that that was all my idea, but it actually was not. I turn up, I'm 21 years old. They've all been and done art and stuff, fine arts and this art and that art, and they know fashion designers and all that. I turn up in like a white shirt, and the guy looks at me and says, "Oh my God, what are we going to do with you?" And he says, "Right, put on this leather jacket. Here's these bug-eye glasses. Right, you're done. And right, where's Paul Thompson? Right, Paul, poor old Paul, actually.
Yeah, Paul
Here's a
got the
tiger
Tarzan
skin."
outfit.
Like, oh, yeah, he hated that. Yeah. So, but we would like hippie music. We were meant to be the token, like,
Right.
one foot in the old guard, one foot in the new guard, and but all power to them. They were a great team, led by Brian Ferry and his friends, and photographers and fashion designers. And they, had, mean that I got it. I understand that rock and roll, when it's really successful, is about image and music.
Yeah.
All of the people you can think of who've come out with it, starting with Elvis and the Gold Army suit and the look and everything, and the music. Music has to be there, and look has to be there to be successful.
Well, speaking of the music, I mean, as Roxy went on, you developed into a real songwriting force in the band. I mean, one of my favorite albums is Siren, which has, I think it's not the popular pick, I guess, because it's a little bit, to me, it's a little bit less produced, but the songs are Nightingale. Those songs are fantastic. So how did that sort of transpire, getting more into the songwriting with Roxy?
Quite a lot of the albums were done very quickly, and because they drove us hard, we had to tour and play sometimes two albums a year and fit in all these tours.
For your
So,
5%, right?
yeah, for your 5%.
We'll get to that later.
Yeah. So, we'd say, they would say, right, you finish your touring then, you're in the studio then. And so you had to come up with something. Well, as I said, we would get in the studio with like three or four chords or five chords and a work out a music arrangement. And then Brian, they say, "All right, Brian, off you go. Good luck." And then he'd come in, and one day he'd come back, and we'd have the backing track to "Love Is the Drug," and no idea what it's going to be called
Right.
or anything. And so he'd come in and say, "Right, I've written something," and then he'd go in and sing it, and then we'd just jump up for joy and say, "Wow, that's fantastic! It's a single! It's like instantly amazing, absolutely brilliant! Thank you." And other times it would be like, yeah, okay, but there's no time. You've got to finish stuff and you've got to get off on tour. So it was the only, there's no spare tracks anywhere.
Yeah.
That's all there was. It
The
was like,
box is going to be lean, the box set.
no box sets for those.
Yeah. Well, let's shift to your solo career. After the first of three breakups of Roxy, I guess we would say. You went out and did your solo albums, Diamond Head, and what was it like putting these projects together? And you seem to be, my overall impression is that you must be a great hang, because you seem to be a great collaborator. You continued to collaborate with Brian, Gilmour and Pink Floyd. So let's talk about your solo career and how that launched, and your direction with it.
Well, a lot of people who are in bands like the opportunity to do a solo project because you can do whatever you want and you're in charge of it. So, but I saw it more as just like a great hang. Yeah, you're right. With my friends, who can I ring up that I haven't played with for years, or people, and do some music with? and have some fun. So
Right.
it was just totally about that. It wasn't about having a solo career. It wasn't about a career. It was just like doing more music and different kind of music. All the other people in the band had done solo albums, and I played on most of them. And I
Right.
put my hand up and said, "Can I do one?" They said, "Yeah, okay, if you insist, you know, and we'll give you like 3 weeks and get on with it between tours." So I did. And now, actually, in September, October, I can't remember, I bring out a box set of 11 solo albums,
Wow.
you know. And so, yeah, I did a lot of solo albuming, but with having great fun with a whole range of different musicians, you know,
Right.
as well as some of the Roxy people as well. So
Well, you
it
had the
was just,
incredible 801 right after
yeah.
Roxy. I mean, that was great. The tomorrow version of Tomorrow Never Knows, which we'll drop into this episode. And a lot of the Impossible Guitars, real guitar stuff. But yeah, so and then I see also, I guess one of the other highlights of your sort of solo career was running that 5-day Guitar Legends concert, which was done in tandem with Expo 92 in Seville. And you had a humorous Bob Dylan story, which if you could relate here.
Well, it's very appropriate that you're in Woodstock, isn't it? I mean,
Yes. Well, he was right. Like I said, he was about 300, 100 yards down the road writing all those the songs.
incredible song. And you know, I'm a huge Bob Dylan fan, but he does, you know, everybody who's worked with him has a Bob Dylan story, you know, and
Right.
he's not obviously the easiest person to work with, but he is Bob Dylan, and I guess we all acquiesce, you know, that he is a master. So I guess, well, I had to rehearse him for this concert, and it was daunting, you know. I was sort of took a big gulp, but I jumped in, and I think he thought I was Mexican because of the name.
Right.
And when he said, "Right, we know all your songs," I had a great band, Jack Bruce, I had Simon Phillips on drums, Pino Palladino, well, no, all sorts of people, Miami Horns. And he said, "No, do you know this Tex-Mex song from 1947?" I was
Oh,
just
there
like,
you go.
"What? Oh my God." I said, No. But I tell you what, yeah, you play it and we'll learn it. It can't be that difficult, I thought.
That play it
Well,
the same.
he played it differently every time, you know,
Yes.
and he started making excuses, leaving the room. And then eventually it was just us two together. And he like looked me in the eye and said, "You know what? Why don't we just get rid of everybody else? Just play two acoustic guitars." And I thought, "Nah, what's gonna die here?" But you know, he we had no idea what he was gonna play. And the manager said, "He might not even come on." I said, "But if he does come on, make sure you introduce him." So obviously, you know, I was in Spanish, so I said, "Senor," I saw him, the spotty shirt in the back, and I thought, Senor, Senor Bob Dylan," as if they didn't know who he
Right.
was, you know. But it was, you know, it was weird. It was kind of weird. We didn't know when we were playing it. You can see it on YouTube. We have no
Yeah, I
idea what
did watch it.
we're
Yeah.
playing.
And you know, something that people may not know is that you had a very big part of your career was being a leading producer of rock Espanola acts. So if you could go a little bit into that. Heroes de Silencio, and how you kind of segued into that.
Okay, so in about 1990, I meet up with the people from Spain, and because I can speak Spanish, they say, "Will you come and produce us?" So I get to meet this young band who's just starting out, and in fact, the singer from that band is playing at Madison Square Gardens on the 12th of June. He's filling out. He's huge. They're now mega stars. He's like, I always said he was like the David Bowie of Spain.
Right.
Incredibly talented. But because I could understand the words, I could understand what people from Argentina, Colombia, Mexico, Puerto Rico were singing about. And they were singing fantastic songs about their own situations and very, very talented. So it became known as Rock in Espanol. And by default, because for a little bit of time I was the only person who spoke Spanish who had a tradition
Right.
of, George Martin School of Production and blah, 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 I became like the hottest producer. So nearly all those people I produce have won Grammys, not only Latin Grammys, but Grammys.
Right.
And they're icons of of South America, Mexico, and Puerto Rico and stuff. And I'm very proud of that. Some of my best productions, were these things. And it's great fun to do.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about we referenced it earlier, but being saddled with bad business deals. You had mentioned that Roxy collectively we were getting six members were getting 5% of the royalties, and then there's sort of the happy story, courtesy of Jay-Z, Kanye West, and what a 88 Keys, right? The beat maker. So let's kind of go into thanks to sampling, you had mentioned that you oh, I might be running out of time, that you had made more from this sampling effort than you did from the other work.
Well, most musicians have this story about how they got paid very little to start with, and it takes years to somehow renegotiate if you don't have the upper hand. And then, out of the blue, this like God said, okay, for all that bad karma, take this. And sampling, yeah. I mean, a lot of rappers have sampled like Robert Fripp from Cream Crimson and all sorts of people. 88 Keys went and took something off one of my solo albums, slowed it down, played it to Kanye when he was doing an album with Jay-Z. They wrote a whole song on it. It won a Grammy. It was in The Great Gatsby. It was in the Denzel Washington film. It was in the ads for the Super Bowl. It was just like winning the lottery. And I realized that that's where the money is, because everybody, most musicians earn nothing from streaming. There's no record shops. We wonder how young musicians are going to pay the bills to continue. And there is money, but in these sinks. So everyone's chasing the sinks,
And this co was completely an accident. It was like you heard about it and you called, I guess, your publishing company, and you're like, yeah, we've been working on this a while, and your record, and then yeah, we know what this is. And you were the last, you're kind of the last man to know. And
That's right.
it's also interesting that you like through this deal, I watched a couple of videos, and A, you had to learn how to play it again, which was
Yes.
kind of funny. 15 minutes on the couch, riffing around is major career financially has helped you,
Actually, I
but
asked David Gilmour while I was in his kitchen. I said,
yeah.
okay, I played it to him. I said, okay, how can you play it? He said, yeah, no problem. And yeah, he didn't play it right. No. And
No,
so
he.
I had to get my like nephew, who's like a youngster, say, oh yeah, because they call read tablature and stuff. So,
Yeah.
oh yeah, this is how you play it. I said, really? Okay. I had to learn it from him.
Well, let's talk about you talked about David Gilmour a couple of times. You've been, as I said, a fantastic collaborator with Brian Eno, Robert Wyatt, and a lot of work with David and the latter day Pink Floyd. So obviously, talk about how you guys hooked up and your work together.
Okay, so I met him when I was 16. I didn't see him again till we were doing the second Roxy Music album, For Your Pleasure, at Air Studios in London. And Studio One and Studio Three, they were mixing Dark Side of the Moon with Chris Thomas,
Right.
mixing, who then came to do our album. I heard the track Money in the control room, and I thought, Jesus, that's incredible guitar playing, I sent him a telegram saying, remember me, I'm in a band now. It's called Roxy Music. And we reconnected. And then, so socially, we began seeing each other over the years. And then eventually, when he was doing the album called Momentary Lapse of Reason, we co-wrote the track, Momentary
Right.
Lapse of Reason, once. And then that continued working together. And I lived next door to him in the country. He hadn't done an album for 10 years. We got together, me just to help him. Obviously, he could produce it himself if he wanted to. He just wanted another ear to listen and stuff. So sort of ended up co-producing, listened to all his bits and pieces, helped put it together. And that was on an island. And then we went on tour, and then we did another, live album, and then Rattle That Lock, and then the Pink Floyd album, Endless River, and stuff like that. So, and that, that finished like a 10-year period, and was still, it was, but thank goodness he got a new producer and a co-producer, and I've heard the album, and it's fantastic, and I love it. So it's my favorite. So that's coming out in September, I think.
Great. So I just have a little more time, so I wanted to wrap up with two things. I'd seen some of the Roxy reunion shows, I believe around 2000. I think so, at Radio City at the beginning of the tour, and then at the end of the tour, it was an interesting dynamic. At the beginning of the tour, it seemed like it was really, Mr. Ferry's show, and then the second, it seemed like the band took over. It was a very interesting dynamic. So I know people are going to want to ask, is that ever going to be a part of your musical career again? And then I really want to talk about what you're doing right now that you're really excited about. We have about 4 minutes for you to wax poetic.
We did a farewell tour in 2 years ago, and we came to the States, primarily in the States. We did three gigs in England, but that was it. We finished at the O2 in London here in September, October 22, and there will be no more live gigs. But we continue sort of working together on different tracks and things like that. There'll probably be more music coming up, but there won't be any more live. I think we felt that we managed to sort of do a good show, and that what's the point, just flogging it after that. So the legacy was good. So that's it for that. However, as soon as that finished, me, Andy Mackay, and Paul Thompson got in the studio here, did an instrumental album called AMPM. And like a month ago, we did three very small gigs, and it's what I call experimental rock. It was different every night. We recorded it, we filmed it, and if people are interested, the people who came, very few people, it was only like 100 people a night, they seem to like it. So maybe there's a future in what I call avant rock.
Yes,
And
please, please.
we're looking forward.
Yes, look forward. Thanks so much for joining us, Phil. I have to highly recommend his book and pretty much any of the 200 albums maybe you're on at the moment and counting. Keep counting. Well, thanks a lot, Phil. And that's it
Thanks
for
very much.
Reading is Funkdemental. Ciao.
Ciao. Bye.